Les colloques du Collège de France.
Well, I am absolutely thrilled to be here celebrating you. So I guess I picked up this slide and you see this red arrow right here. And I don't know how, but I was able to figure out that that's Seb. And he confirmed. There was something about the topography of your head. Yes. Okay. I actually, Harmanton is somewhere on this side, but
you know, I guess I'm here.
When there will be a celebration for you, I'll find you on the picture.
That's a deal.
Yeah. But anyway, so congratulations, Seb, for this great honor that you received here at Collège de France. And happy birthday also. And thank you for organizing this wonderful gathering. Okay, so I'm going to talk about supramolecular motion in cell signaling. That's the main topic. And so just to put give you a little bit of context about things that we have been interested in the last 2 decades or so, we work a lot in bio-inspired supramolecular materials, and there are three topics that have been rather common. One was emulating photosynthetic soft matter, and here there is a whole bunch of papers here, but I noted the first one and the last one, and where we try to mimic the photosynthetic machinery in soft matter. And then also materials that imitate the movements of living creatures. And in this area, we have developed materials that have macroscopic dynamicity, I would say, responding to stimuli of magnetic fields and light in this case. But for the topic of today, I'm going to focus on mimics of mammalian extracellular matrices. Our translational objective is to develop therapies for regenerative medicine. And so what we want to do is create artificial forms of an extracellular matrix. Here you see the elements, which are typically one-dimensional structures. And there's a long history in our development of these structures. So the concept of regenerative medicine is still elusive, I would say. And it is elusive because and the idea is that you want to regenerate everything in contrast to what we did going back to the mid of the 20th century, which is to make synthetic materials and implants and try to fix everything that way with well-known materials. But it's been elusive to achieve regeneration, in part because for some reason this field has focused on stem cell therapies. That has been the goal, and that's an extremely difficult goal. It still doesn't work well. It's difficult to scale up, reproducibility issues. There's lots of problems. So people have lost faith, you know, for that reason. And so what we are trying to develop does not involve the use of stem cells, but instead it uses bioactive soft matter. And hopefully, eventually, we will probably be able to combine the two. And we do everything with supramolecular materials. Everybody understands what those are. They're basically non-covalent structures, because all of the interactions that you use to design them are non-covalent. And there's a large variety of systems going from MOFs to many other things that are developed, have been developed this way with non-covalent structures. They are, of course, iconic of self-assembly, naturally. Since you don't use chemical reactions to create the final functional structure. My main point of the lecture is that we have to depart from the highly static structures, which is how the field started. And MOFS, of course, is iconic of static structure. And that has captured, you know, a lot of interest. But I think it's important to take these, you know, energy tunable systems, the supramolecular materials, into the dynamic state so that we can imitate motions of living creatures, adapt to environments. And most important, to relevant to the lecture, is to create active movement that is similar to that of the biological machinery, so that the material has to be highly dynamic the way biology is. So, because you can't really be very effective if on the one side you have static structures and you're trying to signal highly dynamic structures, which is what biology is. So my argument then is that we need four-dimensional design. So the structures have to be, and this is a very rich area, so the fourth dimension here is time, right? Structures changing in time. So depart from just three-dimensional design, which is the more traditional way, and step into the fourth dimensions, right? For time as the fourth dimension. This is very much aligned with, is very much a bio-inspired area. Now, so the systems that we use are supramolecular therapeutic peptide amphiphiles. That's how I would describe them. I want to point out that some of the new drugs that are available right now for diabetes are peptide amphiphiles, in fact. And so Ozempic, which is the king or the queen of this field, you know, the Gila monster peptide, you know, from the venomous lizard, is a peptide amphiphile. You sort of see the architecture here, except that they placed it or in an orthogonal position to the semaglutide, which is the Gila monster peptide. And this is, of course, what you're trying to mimic, GLP-1, and this is the peptide. But I want to point out that in 2012, we created a peptide amphiphile that was a GLP-1 mimetic and found that it stimulated insulin production or secretion. I don't know how I missed this. All I can tell you is that I remember meeting with some people that came to visit Northwestern from Novo Nordisk. And we talked, and they didn't say anything. I should have gotten stock in Novo Nordisk, right, at that time. But anyway, so here is the paper. It's a 2012 paper. And it's very nice. You can see here is a very short aliphatic tail right here, and it self-assembles in the usual way with hydrophobic collapse of the core, and then displaying on the surface of the nanostructures the signaling peptide, which in this case is a GLP-1 mimetic. So it's a kind of a truncated form of the full hormone. Okay. So how do these systems signal? Well, I mean, this is a static view of cell signaling, sort of. So here are the receptors. Here is a fiber with a co-assembly of two molecules making the red background, and then another one with signals in yellow, and they are the ones that are targeting the receptors. And then sometimes we use a molecule, for example, that might recognize a specific protein and then use the protein to signal, but the supramolecular peptide amphiphile assembly is there to manage the protein, orient it in the right way or protect it from enzymatic degradation and so forth. So this was without considering dynamics, and we've worked on regeneration of bone, cartilage, spinal cord, skeletal muscle, heart, tooth enamel, blood vessels. We've done all of these things. But with a static view of signaling. Okay. Here is one example, and I point to this one because this one was just granted breakthrough status by the FDA, and the clinical trial is either going to be toward the very end of this year, but most likely, I think, at the beginning of next year. But it is a basically a putty-like material you see here. It's like a putty. And this material, which is a hybrid because it has a number of components, this is the bioactive molecule right here. And in 8 weeks, this putty turns into real bone, fully vascularized, wherever you put it in the skeletal system. And then we have another one that does something similar, but except for the regeneration of cartilage. But this is the one, hopefully, that will go into clinical trials first. And so we are right now planning the trial. It is going to be a trial on spinal fusion, which is an increasingly important surgery these days because of aging problems. And people have pain in their back. And so it's an important target. And cartilage, of course, it's super important, and I tore a meniscus a few months ago. Who knows how? I don't know yet. But I really appreciate it. So I'm kind of working for myself, right? Trying to solve this problem. I get emails about cartilage problems every single day. You can go into my computer and verify. It's an amazing problem. Because cartilage has no capacity to regenerate itself. Here is a paper that we just finished this past year, and it was a 6-month study in sheep. So that's sort of the last animal you test before you do a clinical trial. And we have very nice cartilage regeneration judging by the expression of collagen 2 and proteoglycans. Using the system that I showed you that has the capacity to recognize the protein TGF-beta-1 for signaling in chondrogenesis. So all of these, this work was started in my lab with us being totally unaware of how important motion was. Supramolecular motion and dynamicity, right? So before I describe that in more detail, so how do you design a peptide amphiphile? Well, I'm going to use FGF2 protein as the example because that's a very extremely important protein for all kinds of regeneration, has many, many types of bioactivity. So you have a segment of this protein which then gets recognized and extracted to build the terminus of a peptide amphiphile, and then we append to it all the various domains that are necessary for the self-assembly, supramolecular polymerization, solubility, etc., and you end up with a molecule. If you look at the ligands, the natural ligands, you see these sites that come mostly from crystallographic data of primary and secondary sites. And then in the receptor, and then those bind to the ligands, and this tetrameric complex is signaling. Well, if I make a peptide amphiphile, I would argue this is the way it needs to be in 4 dimensions, right? So you need clustering of the signal right here, which is this peptide now, amphiphile. Here's a receptor getting signaled. And my point here is that the way this signaling takes place in this highly dynamic situation has, I would argue, little to do with the way Emil Fischer pictured this. So this is the lock and key concept here is really very weak, I would say. And this is interesting because sometimes you see sites in the crystal structure that are kind of distant from the actual ligand receptor interaction. They're distant, but they still participate somehow in the signaling. That means that we don't really understand how this works. The proteins are probably extremely dynamic to begin with. They're moving around a lot, some more than others. And so the signal, each individual molecule in this cluster, they cooperatively touch the receptor in all the right places to activate it, right? So it's not a lock and key situation. It's a much more dynamic process. So it should be more like this, right? So I'm gonna show you now from this paper in 2021 how the recognizing that there is supramolecular motion and a lot of dynamicity in the assemblies reaching out to receptors, molecules jumping up vertically or maybe even translating along the length of the assembly, right? You'd never think about a polymer having structural unit in position 1 going to position 150. But in this case, that can happen. The monomer can walk from position 10 to position 200. It can jump up, come back down. It might even leave, but come back again. So it's a different, really different world. And now, why is this so important and so interesting to think about scientifically? Well, the landscape on the cell surface is very crowded in terms of many different kinds of receptors. They can start pre-clustering, but how in the world do the ligands recognize in this space so efficiently their targets? Because they are moving very rapidly, and so, of course, what you're signaling with, which is the supramolecular system, should be moving also a lot, and changing like KD values depending on how dynamic the system is. So in some systems where they're not very dynamic, the KDs are going to be completely different from those in very dynamic systems. So I want to show you the surprising bioactivity that you can get in these 4D supramolecular biomaterials. And we have focused recently on the brain and the spinal cord. So we have great interest in neural problems because I think these are problems that humanity really needs to solve for quality of life and to face all the aging problems. And so we started with spinal cord injury because this is of enormous humanitarian importance. And everybody in the world is like a minute away from losing movement forever as a result of a car accident or something else. It's a devastating human injury. But we are also working now on stroke, and we're working on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS. But I'm going to illustrate the dynamicity issue with the problem of spinal cord injury. So here is the story. This is from this paper in 2021. We designed one molecule. This is the signal. It's a laminin mimic. And we put in the normal domain where we typically use for polymerization, for supramolecular polymerization, we either installed a tetrapeptide V2A2 or the tetrapeptide A2G2. Okay? And then found that the bottom line is that the PA1 with this tetrapeptide had very slow motion, and the one with PA2, A2G2, had very fast motion. You can see differences in wide angle scattering, fluorescence, depolarization, and measurements of NMR all indicate that the motion is very different in both. And it was really interesting to find, which I think is remarkable, that this tiny change of that tetrapeptide, without touching the bioactive signal, right, the disease-curing sequence, basically, when you put human neural stem cells on top, you see after a week or so, lots of neurons here in white appearing on this carpet of lots of red and green, which are these markers for stemness. And you see neurons appearing on the surface. You see maybe one neuron right here. So just because the molecules are moving, you make a lot more neurons in one, and you make very few neurons in the other. You know, we were really astonished by this result. It had a direct connection to dynamicity. And you saw on that slide, though I didn't talk about it, we demonstrated this by computer simulation also. So then when it came to the problem of spinal cord injury to reverse paralysis, what we did is we mixed two molecules, not just one. So this is the one you just saw. This is the highly active one with a laminin signal. And then we introduced an FGF2, the case I showed you how to design a PA. This is the FGF2 mimetic. Here is the sequence. And so what is remarkable here is that if you put the same A2G2, which is the fast one that makes neurons, in both signals, the paralysis is not restored. I mean, it's restored a little bit. You'll see it in the movie. But if you cross them, so meaning if you put A2G2 with signal 1, and then you put V2A2 with signal 2, if you cross them, then the paralysis is reversed, which is really interesting. And what's happening is that there's a lot more motion. The reason is when you have the same peptide in both, they mix, and it's almost like they're kind of frozen. They don't move very much. But when they have different tetrapeptides, and now we know that A2G2 hates V2A2, they don't like to mix. So they phase separate inside the fiber, and then they make clusters of the minority one, which is the FGF2. And those clusters that you saw in that movie before are the one signaling. So for good signaling, you need clustering and you need dynamics too. You need both. And so then the paralysis is restored. And so we went and developed the model for a spinal cord injury process. And this, by the way, is also under planning for clinical trials. We're talking to the FDA right now, and we're hoping that they will allow us to start a phase one. But of course, in this case, phase one is really phase two also, right? Because you don't do the safety. There's no placebo, nobody's gonna sign up for placebo here. So we have to do a combination. But anyway, this is proceeding. And so here is the proof of what I just told you. The full paralysis of the mouse is shown here, is a severe injury. A lot of people that work in spinal cord injury, they don't do severe injuries, and so they do mild injuries, and so the results there are different. This is really severe. And then we either use the slow-moving molecules, the green and the orange are the signals, FGF2 is the orange, and this is the fast moving with the clusters. You see they phase separate, as I explained before. They phase separate and they move very fast. And these guys mix very well or mix better, but they don't move. And so then 4 weeks later, the fully paralyzed animal, if you inject the slow ones, you get a little bit of recovery in the hind limbs, a little bit. But not very impressive. But then if you inject the fast-moving system, then you get pretty much almost normal walking behavior. Now, this is really remarkable. I'm not changing signals here. I'm just manipulating the parts of the peptide sequence that impact on dynamicity. That's what I'm doing. And the results are really interesting, I would say. If you do the histology, you see this, the slow and fast motion. And so, for example, slow motion, this is a dye that you inject in the brain, and it allows you to follow regenerating axons in the spinal cord. So the key here is that to regenerate the axons in the central nervous system, whether it's in your brain or your spinal cord, is super difficult. And reestablish synaptic connections. They just don't grow. They grow, of course, during development, maybe in very early childhood, but in the adult, is extremely difficult. So you see here, this is like regenerating axons. This is the epicenter of the injury, right here, the dashed line. And you see that in the fast motion, with the recovery of walking ability, the regenerating axons cross over this magic line here, which is the epicenter of the injury, and you see regeneration going on down there. And here, you don't see it in the slow. And then, if you look at the cross sections, you see in the fast motion, you see the effect of the FGF2, which is a mitotic and angiogenic signal. This dye is injected, DII is injected in the heart, and the red indicates that there are functional blood vessels in the injured spinal cord. And very few in the slow one, slow motion one, very many blood vessels in the fast one. And very recently, and by the way, this is how the system is known this way by the patients of spinal cord injury. So, because that's the way it was advertised in a BBC World News program when I published the paper, and so it stayed as the dancing molecules. This is interesting, and this paper is hopefully we'll see it accepted soon, but these are human spinal cord organoids that we grow in our lab, and they're very large, and they're very large because we are doing injuries of the human spinal cord organoids. But when in the media you put the fast-moving molecules with this tetrapeptide A2G2, you see axons emanating out of the organoid, just growing. And this is human tissue. This is not mouse tissue. This is human. And you don't see that in the slow one. Okay, very recently we showed that the effect is pretty universal because we see an effect in cartilage regeneration, the other important target. In this case, the signal is the cyclic peptide that mimics TGF-beta-1 protein and activates the TGF-beta-1 receptor for chondrogenesis. And using NMR, and we were looking at beta protons in alanine residues, gamma protons in glutamic acid residues, and even in the aliphatic tail, we were looking also at protons there, and uniformly based on T2 relaxation times, and we actually mapped out that the ones that had the higher relaxation times, the ones that are more mobile, molecules are more mobile, they give rise to more cartilage production. And you see this very, very vividly in the in vitro experiment. These are chondrocytes following the deposition of aggrecan in red. And so lower T2, slower motion, in high T2, greater motion, and you see a very, very vivid difference in the aggrecan deposition, which is one of the components of cartilage matrix. Now, as we explained this in this paper, which was just published, and it was a joint work with Bert Meyer and our common postdoc, Hua Xuan Du. So he came from EPFL, And I couldn't get him to my lap, and you can imagine or guess why not. I won't do this publicly because you never know who is in the audience. But I stationed him in Bert's lap. Bert hosted him, and so we worked together and produced this paper, which was just published. I won't say very much about the paper, but I think if I show you this animation here, you'll see where we're going in terms of what the model is. We think that what happens in the highly mobile systems, they're so mobile that actually tiny spherical micelles or semi-spherical are in equilibrium with filaments. So there is an equilibrium between one-dimensional and zero-dimensional structures. But these guys, you know, the little ones, just imagine how, I mean, they're highly mobile. They can go to a receptor and when they come out of the fiber, and then they might go back to the fiber, and then in many micelles can then grow new filaments, and so it's an equilibrium. That's our model. There's an equilibrium. So it's a dual state self-assembly. In self-assembly, one of the problems is that we're so fixated on static, beautiful structures that it's almost heresy to say that there are two different states of assembly in equilibrium with each other. And that's what's happening here. And so it's almost like you create messengers that go out of the filaments to signal the receptor, and then they can come back. So there is an equilibrium. And the NMR, you know, is, these days we're doing magic angle spinning, and these experiments are really making me broke, you know, because they're so expensive. I mean, we use isotopes. I mean, it's a pretty complex project. But I just want to point, and there's a lot of information here. The manuscript is being prepared right now. But I just want to point a few things because I think they're so vivid. This is the peptide alpha file with a laminin signal that has low bioactivity. Look at that NMR spectrum. It's flat. Because now we're not doing even solution. I mean, we are doing magic angle spinning so we can see large filaments, actually. And look at the one with high bioactivity. You can see the AMET protons. And here, of course, you can see them. But look here. All kinds of peaks are visible in the highly bioactive one, and it's totally flat right here. The other thing, the aromatic protons of the FGF2 signal, because they are tyrosines in that peptide sequence, and so you don't see anything in the pure FGF2, but when you mix the two peptide amphiphiles, now you see aromatic peaks, which proves the co-assembly, which is very interesting. And here you see what I told you earlier, that one combination of two PAs reverses paralysis and the other one does not. So all of this is consistent with the NMR signals. Now, if you look at this work, which is unpublished, this is atomistic simulation, and so this is the low motion system. I mean, you can see it here. This is the one that doesn't make many neurons or anything. This is a real all-atom molecular dynamics simulation done by my postdoc. And now we look at the high motion one, and this is what the simulation shows. There's fission going on. See, the simulation recreates this concept that the cluster of the molecules is separating into two daughter assemblies when it's highly dynamic. And this can be justified by also looking at the hydrogen bonds, since this is all atom. The density of hydrogen bonds is higher in one versus the other, right? So if you look at V2A2 here, you have more hydrogen bonds, and that's why there is less motion in that system. So now, as I come to the end of the talk, I'll show you what is our next challenge is to solve the problem of chronic spinal cord injury. What I showed you about the mouse in the conversation we're having with FDA is to run a trial for acute spinal cord injury, which means that would eventually eradicate paralysis, hopefully, if it one day works well. But you have to treat the patient shortly after the injury. That's why it's called acute. The problem is, how do we deal with people like this lady here in our hospital across the street from my office who has chronic injury, right? And she's going through therapies and electrical stimulation and all kinds of things. Look what happens in chronic spinal cord injury. You get a hole, okay? There is about 15 million people living with permanent paralysis in the world. 15 million. So there is a hole. This is in the rat, but the same thing happens in the human. So to solve this problem is much more challenging. We have new signals that we're working with, new molecules. One of the many molecules we have, this one is like a drug from the pharmaceutical industry. It takes 26 steps to make. And my argument is that if this is going to cure or allow a chronically injured patient to walk again, somebody will pay for it. It will happen. But because there's 26 chemical reactions. Now, I want you to see, this is very early work, this is not published yet, but you see this this is a rat that is in an early chronic model, not acute anymore, and there's full paralysis here, as you can see. And then with some of these new molecules that we have, we're very excited that we actually can see movement of the limbs, even though it's early chronic. And we can see, like, this is the scar border that is in this cavity that you saw here, which is impossible to penetrate. You have to use a specific receptor to trick the axon into crossing a region that is rich in chondroitin sulfate, okay, proteoglycan. And it doesn't happen. And so we are trying to reverse that with these signals. And this mouse, so I, last week before I came to Paris, I went to the lab and I told my postdoc, I said, can I get a movie of one of our most impressive ones? I mean, of all the molecules that we're testing, we're testing combinations of molecules different from the ones in the science paper. So this, just look at this rat. Okay, and this is pretty impressive. I think he is on a treadmill, and in this particular animal, we know because we have the tape, was completely paralyzed at the beginning, and after the treatment, this is like 8 weeks 8 weeks later. We see, you know, pretty decent walking, so we're very excited. We still don't know which combination of molecules this is, because we're still blind. But we singled out this particular animal as an example, and we have many like this who were completely paralyzed chronically and then eventually regain function. I will finish up just giving you a very brief example of all the things that we do. So this is a interesting molecule that we've been working with. It's based on trihalose, which is this naturally occurring sugar in insects, plants, and fungi. And this is for a project on Alzheimer's disease. It was just published in JAX. The thing that's interesting here is that we originally thought of trihalose, which is this sugar here, because this sugar protects insects, for example, and plants from freezing. It protects them from protects the proteins. And so we thought maybe this would, you know, would protect somehow the nasty molecules, the nasty proteins that polymerize in Alzheimer's and so forth. So what we found is something quite interesting. So we found that these assemblies right here, which you see here, they copolymerize with A-beta 42 peptide, which is the culprit in Alzheimer's disease, for example. And you see this in confocal, where they, this is the trihalose A-beta 42. You see a lot of yellow because they are copolymerized. The computer simulation demonstrates that the protein copolymerizes with our TPA, this trihalose protein, and it's a heterotypic polymerization in a supramolecular sense because it hits many different types of amino acids as it copolymerizes with a peptide. This is on, we have demonstrated that iPSC-derived human neurons are actually rescued by this copolymerization. So basically, the A-beta 42 copolymerizes with our peptide amplifier fiber and rescues the neurons from death. You see it very strikingly here. Lots of green and then red dots here. These are dead neurons due to A-beta 42. And when we introduce the supramolecular assemblies, we get green. We get living neurons. So this is an interesting example, a very different take. Now, what is the connection to the dynamicity and the motion and all that? The only way that this copolymerization works, and I invite you to read the paper, is if you have the assembly in a non-equilibrium state where the molecules are still highly dynamic, because you haven't annealed them. If you anneal them and establish all the hydrogen bonding that they want to have, this copolymerization and rescue of the neurons doesn't happen. So it's a very different example. And then my last comment is that one of the things moving forward could be, this connects a little bit to Harmanton's talk this morning, because in this paper we showed, we made these oligovinylidene fluoride, which Harmanton mentioned that polymer in the talk. This is one of the known piezoelectric, pyroelectric, ferroelectric polymers. So we took these little tiny segments. It was kind of hard to make them and purify them, but we managed. It was a 3-year project. And this molecule that you see here then is it's a peptide, 4 amino acids, and then instead of an alkyl tail, it's a vinylidene fluoride tail, and it has a dipole moment, and so it basically assembles and makes ribbons and fibrils depending on sequences. And the hydrogen bonding established by the beta sheets here somehow stabilize the old transconformation of the vinylidene fluoride and then makes a ferroelectric material. Now, what does this have to do with the rest of the lecture? Well, the reason this is important is because of this cartoon right here. Because it turns out that neurons respond, and maybe other cells as well, but neurons definitely respond to electrical signals, and they benefit from the presence of a polar structure. And so what we want to do is basically, now that we know we can do this, somehow find a way to incorporate biological signals here and do orthogonal bioactivity, which is based on the electrical effect and also the bioactivity. Okay, so won't take too much to read this over, but I think you understand that the supramolecular dimension and function are an interesting direction. I hope you appreciate that. Hopefully you appreciated the fourth dimension of synthetic systems, which is important to cell signaling. And this is a very important thing, the bioinspiration and the biomimetic nature has to do with intrinsically disordered proteins. Every week you will see reports of a new intrinsically disordered protein is discovered in our genome. Okay, so how does that work? Well, it means that proteins that don't have a well-defined folded structure, they're instead very dynamic, the way these assemblies are, and they have a special way of signaling. And in fact, they can respond to an environment and then signal, because they can move and they can hide the signal, and then they can display the signal. So it's not a nicely folded protein showing its lock, waiting for the key to come in. Anyway, so, and then the other thing, one last point, is that a very fertile ground is when you try to integrate completely orthogonal functions. So this is how I see the integration, for example, of bioactivity to signal receptors in cell signaling, but also introducing perhaps electrical signals that come from an extremely different effect. Anyway, so many thanks to a lot of people and for, well, to my group, of course, and for funding. And these guys, who knows what they're going to do in the next few years, but I am very lucky to have, you know, philanthropic help and foundation help, and this is how most of this work is now taking place independent of Mr. Trump. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.